May he rot in the hell he wrote so often about in his journals.
On Friday, the 11th of June 2009, Joanne Witt's co-workers were concerned when she failed to show up for work in El Dorado, California. Over the weekend, they routinely checked at her home. The air conditioning was switched on, but nobody answered the door. By Monday, their concern had escalated so much that they promptly reported her missing. Joanne Witt, a resident of El Dorado, California, was a dedicated single mother to her daughter, Tyler. Their relationship had faced a setback when Tyler was 5 years old and was temporarily placed in the care of her grandfather by Child Protective Services. This followed an incident where Joanne had struck her daughter in the face. However, Tyler was later returned to Joanne's custody, and she wholeheartedly worked to provide the best life possible for her daughter. Despite the challenges they faced, Joanne was determined to give Tyler a well-rounded upbringing. She introduced her to activities such as piano, violin, horseback riding, skiing, and she fostered her interests in music and acting. As a single mother, Joanne tirelessly pursued her own career, having earned a master's degree in metallurgy from California Polytechnic State University. This allowed her to secure a position as an assistant in the engineering unit of the county's Department of Transportation. They lived in an upscale 3,200-square-foot home in the 200 block of Tattinger Court, a middle-class neighbourhood of brick and concrete stucco homes with well-manicured lawns. Her former sister-in-law, Mary Witt, fondly recalled, "Whenever she saw something that needed to be done, or someone needing help, she'd make sure it got done, and got done right." At home, Joanne liked to cook and she enjoyed spending time in the outdoors. She was highly regarded at her workplace, and her co-workers became close friends who enjoyed spending time together beyond office hours. One co-worker, Vincent Catapano, praised her by saying, "She was smart, caring, fun to be around. Everybody at work just loved her." During Thanksgiving in 2008, Joanne generously treated all of her co-workers to an office feast, meticulously preparing a turkey and all of the fixings. In addition to her successful career, Joanne actively participated in numerous charitable events, including Walks for Cancer. She genuinely cared for those around her and even extended her compassion to strangers. In December of 2008, Joanne's 14-year-old daughter, Tyler, was introduced to a 19-year-old man named Stephen Paul Culver. Among his friends, he was known as Boston, and he had a deep fascination with Japanese culture, including anime, swords, and knives. Stephen worked as a shift leader at Rubio's Restaurant and had graduated from Oak Ridge High School in 2008. He aspired to become a maths teacher and had enrolled at Folsom Lake College. As recalled by a friend, Zachariah Erson, he was one of the few people who knew what he was doing in life. He had goals. Tyler was immediately smitten by the older man, who was 5 years her senior. Quickly, the relationship turned sexual despite the fact that Tyler was a minor and Stephen was committing statutory rape. Tyler later said of Stephen, "I trusted him more than I trusted anyone, and I love him more than anybody or anything. If he told me to jump off a bridge, and I asked him why and he said just trust me, I would have done it." After school, Stephen would pick Tyler up in his car, and he quickly became a negative influence on her life as her grades began to fall. The duo also dabbled in drugs, including marijuana, cocaine, and ecstasy. Stephen's friends had tried to warn him about the implications of his relationship with Tyler, but he wouldn't listen. One day, Stephen's friend, Matt Bogart, said to him, "Sooner or later, you're going to be talking to a police officer." Over at Stephen's home, his father was becoming annoyed with his unruly behaviour and kicked him out of the house. Stephen knew exactly where to turn. Stephen and Tyler came up with a plan so that he could move in with her and Joanne. Tyler told her mother that he was gay and simply a platonic friend and suggested that he rent a room in their home. Joanne wasn't sure, but she took pity on Stephen. She thought that he seemed to be a good guy and he could even help Tyler with her tutoring. As Richard Lavallee, a co-worker of Joanne, said, she took him off the streets. She gave him a place to stay. One evening, the trio met with Stephen's father, Richard, at a restaurant in Folsom to discuss the plan. The meeting was strange to Richard, who later commented, it was really odd. You could feel the tension between Tyler and her mom. You could cut it with a knife. After that, it was decided that Stephen would move in with the Witt family and he could occupy the spare bedroom. In due course, however, Joanne would come to learn the truth about their disturbing relationship. On the 14th of May 2009, Joanne returned home from work to find Stephen's bedroom door open. As she approached it, Stephen came out partially clothed. Joanne called for her daughter, but there was no response. An ominous thought came across Joanne, and she barged into Stephen's bedroom to find Tyler naked in the closet. Joanne was furious. It quickly dawned on her that Stephen wasn't gay, and that had been a ruse to allow him to move in with Tyler, her teenage daughter. She ordered Stephen to get out of the house and told him that if he left Tyler alone, then she would press charges against him. Tyler begged her mother to change her mind, telling her that she and Stephen were in love, but Joanne wouldn't have it. After all, Tyler was just 14 years old, and Stephen was committing statutory rape. While Stephen was packing his bags, Joanne called her co-worker, Vincent, and asked him to come over just in case the situation turned nasty. When he arrived, he suggested to Joanne that she go to police and report the incident because Tyler was a minor. Joanne said that she considered it, but Tyler had insisted that she was in love and she didn't want to hurt her daughter. Despite Joanne forbidding Tyler from seeing Stephen, she still routinely snuck him into the home. And when Joanne caught wind of this, she had no choice other than to report him to police. When a detective called up Stephen, he denied that he was sexually abusing Tyler. He said to the detective, she's like a sister to me. I understand she's 14. I understand all this. I'm very, very scared at the moment. Shortly after this incident, Joanne was at home when she came across Tyler's journal. In the journal, Tyler wrote about how much she loved Stephen and went into explicit sexual detail about their relationship. She also wrote that she wasn't sure how long she could keep their relationship a secret from her mother. Tyler's anger towards her mother was evident in the journal, as she wrote about how she imagined her mother dying. She wrote, I would curse her with the plague of death if it didn't come back three times as hard. I imagine my mom slamming into a truck, going 55 miles per hour, crushing her skull and pelvis. She dies from the impact. In another entry, Tyler had written, my mother is driving me insane. I can't stand her company for more than 5 minutes. I hate her. She's bipolar insane and is turning me into the same thing. I just wish she would die somehow, some way, and leave me the fuck alone. On the 11th of June 2009, Joanne took Tyler to El Dorado County detectives investigating the statutory rape case. Tyler denied the sexual relationship, which resulted in Joanne handing the detectives her journal, which went into great detail. Tyler was absolutely stunned. She began pacing back and forth and screamed obscenities at her mother. She then went into school that morning and chatted with her friend, Dylan Dutch, about wanting her mother dead. Tyler said to Dylan, "If she died, I wouldn't be sad." Dylan called her a liar and questioned, "You really believe you wouldn't be sad?" Tyler responded, No, I would be genuinely happy. Upon returning home, Tyler called Stephen over, and they began speaking about their options. They knew that Stephen was going to be arrested for statutory rape, but they wanted to be together. The conversation quickly turned ominous, and Tyler suggested that they commit a Romeo and Juliet suicide pact. Their plan was to drive to San Francisco and take their lives, but Tyler worried that as soon as her mother noticed them missing, she would call police. Tyler then turned to Stephen and said that her mother needed to die. Later that afternoon, Joanne was at work when her phone began to ring. Her co-worker, Vincent, recalled. She was handling the whole thing extraordinarily well. She would say, "When you calm down, we'll talk more about it." She was on the phone with her daughter, Tyler. And eventually, Joanne left work early that day to return home and speak to her daughter. She was unaware of the grim plan that she and Stephen had just concocted hours earlier. That evening, Joanne sat down with a glass of brandy after a heated debate with Tyler. When Joanne retreated to bed for the night, Tyler texted Stephen. He scaled a back fence to bypass a neighborhood security gate. Tyler then led him into the home, armed with a knife from the restaurant where he worked. Meanwhile, Tyler obtained a knife from the kitchen. Stephen silently entered Joanne's bedroom, standing beside her bed while Tyler waited outside. Suddenly, Stephen raised the knife above his head and stabbed Joanne multiple times. Joanne awoke during the brutal assault and valiantly fought back, sustaining defensive wounds to her hands. The attack left Joanne with over 20 stab wounds, including a severe one that appeared to have slashed her throat. Covered in blood, Stephen emerged from the bedroom, and Tyler swiftly went about securing the scene. Stephen covered her with a SpongeBob SquarePants blanket to prevent blood from spreading. Tyler then closed the windows and blinds and turned on the air conditioning to mask any odour and create the illusion that Joanne was present and alive. After the murder, Stephen and Tyler drove to their friend Matthew Widman's house. They proceeded to dye their hair, raising Matthew's curiosity. When Matthew inquired about their actions, Stephen and Tyler claimed that they had planned to run away and end their lives, but refused to provide further details, promising to explain later. The trio then visited the town centre to hang out, before going to Stephen's father's house. Finding his father absent, they indulged in marijuana and cocaine. Later, Stephen retrieved a white shopping bag from his car, revealing a large blood-stained knife to Matthew, confessing that he had killed Joanne. He described stabbing her in the throat and stomach while Tyler stood outside the bedroom. He then chillingly disclosed Joanne's final words. "No, Boston, no." Matthew later recalled, "We talked a little and said our goodbyes, then I went back home. That was the last I saw them." Matthew said that he didn't ask why they had killed Tyler's mother, nor did he think to report it to police. As he said, he was shocked and surprised. Later that afternoon, Matthew called two friends who also knew the couple, Matt Bogart and Dylan Dutch. He asked them to meet him at a local Safeway store, which they did. Matthew informed Matt and Dylan of Stephen's ominous confession, and Matt immediately called up Stephen. He demanded, "I want to know what you have to tell me." Stephen replied that he had killed Joanne and that her body was in the master bedroom covered with a blanket. During the phone call, Stephen also told Matt that he and Tyler were driving to San Francisco to kill themselves. Matt attempted to talk Stephen out of it, but he said that it was their only recourse to be together. He then added, "I can't really live without her. We need to do this." Over the next hour, Matt chatted with Stephen on the phone and tried to talk him out of the suicide pact. But Stephen said that there was no alternative. The following morning, Joanne failed to appear at work as usual, causing concern among her co-workers. Numerous attempts to reach her by phone went unanswered, intensifying their worry. Joanne's close friend and co-worker, Vincent, decided to visit her home after work. He knocked on the front door but received no response. He left but returned periodically over the weekend, hoping to find Joanne home. But each time, nobody answered the door. As Monday arrived and Joanne still hadn't shown up for work, her co-worker's concern escalated into fear. They knew Joanne to be punctual and reliable, and her absence was highly unusual. Vincent took action and contacted the police, requesting a welfare check on Joanne. An officer made an initial call to Joanne's father, Norb, who agreed to meet him at Joanne's home. With a spare key in hand, Norb opened the front door but was instructed to wait outside while the officer conducted a search of the premises. Upstairs, the officer made a horrifying discovery. Joanne's lifeless body, stained with blood, was lying in her bed covered by a blanket. News of Joanne's brutal murder quickly spread throughout the community, drawing attention from both neighbours and the media. Residents gathered outside, sharing their shock and disbelief. Winter Aubin, one neighbour, voiced the collective sentiment asking, "What could provoke something that serious?" Just days after the heinous murder, however, El Dorado Sheriff Sergeant Jim Byers made an announcement. He said that they were actively searching for Stephen and Tyler in connection with Joanne's murder.
Information developed by detectives through their investigation has led us to believe that they've changed their appearance and are trying to avoid law enforcement.
And why wait until today to release this information if this is something you believed yesterday?
Well, it wasn't information we believed yesterday. It was part of the ongoing investigation. Initially, the daughter was simply a missing person. She wasn't at the home. We had no ties. Through the night, the detectives have worked on this, and through their investigation, they developed the information, and now we are confident that both the daughter and the boyfriend are suspects.
Detectives were aware of the previous incident involving the statutory rape allegation. Furthermore, Matthew and Matt had come forward, informing detectives that Stephen had confessed to them about the murder and their plan to flee to San Francisco to end their lives. Did you catch wind of the University of Arizona's latest forecasts? They're sounding the alarm for the upcoming 2023 hurricane season, predicting that it will resemble the intensity of 2017. With that in mind, they're urging everybody to gear up and be ready for whatever might come our way. Have you ever considered the sheer devastation a hurricane can cause? Let's take Hurricane Ida's blow to the Gulf Coast as an example. Homes were obliterated, leaving people without basic essentials such as food and clean water. Power vanished for countless, and the floods turned roads into rivers, shutting down grocery supply chains. Here's the scoop on safeguarding your family during these scenarios. For Patriots, emergency food kits. These kits offer long-lasting, tasty grub designed to keep you fueled when it matters most. These kits are handpicked in the US, are good for up to 25 years, and are packed with a diverse range of delicious meals. And trust me, thousands of 5-star reviews back them up. For Patriot, survival food isn't just for natural disasters. In today's topsy-turvy world where supply chains waver and emergency services surprise us, having a solid backup plan is crucial. And right now, you can go to 4patriots.com and use the code Morbidology to get 10% off your first purchase on anything in the store, including their emergency food supply kits designed to last up to 25 years. Just go to 4patriots.com and use the code Morbidology to get 10% off your first purchase of 4Patriots Survival Food. That's 4patriots.com and use the code Morbidology. That same morning, detectives had found the vehicle that the pair had been driving in a construction zone in downtown San Francisco. When they searched the car, they found a suicide note that Stephen had written to his mother. In it, he thanked her for instilling in him a sense of moral justice and said that she had brought him up to be considerate to others at all times. He also expressed his regret for not appreciating her when he had the chance. It read in part, "I love her very much, and I wish I could have been a better son to her. The note also mentioned Tyler, writing, "I could go to hell and back for her. Bear eternal damnation just to be with her and know that she's happy." The note then continued, "I have always viewed suicide as the permanent solution to the weak. If I kill myself, it proves the world is stronger than I." Detectives released photographs of the fugitive pair, describing Stephen as 6'1" tall and Tyler as 5'1" tall. They also alerted the public to the fact that Stephen and Tyler may have altered their appearance in an attempt to evade capture. The revelation that Stephen and Tyler were the main suspects in the murder horrified those who knew the family. According to neighbours, they appeared to be just your average American family. Once news broke, Stephen and Tyler's friends began posting on their Facebook accounts, urging them to hand themselves in. One of Stephen's friends pleaded with him to stop running and warned that he was only making it worse. Another friend posted, "Dude, you've got to quit running. We're all worried about you here. Please, Boston, you once told me that you would never be capable of such a thing. Prove me right. Prove yourself right." Early the next morning, Stephen and Tyler were spotted sleeping outside a strip mall in San Bruno. Detectives quickly descended on the scene and arrested them without incident. Stephen was booked into the San Mateo County Jail, while Tyler was sent to juvenile hall while both awaiting extradition back to El Dorado. In announcing the arrest, Captain Craig Thurgilston stated, "We can all breathe a collective sigh of relief." During their time on the run, Stephen and Tyler had sought refuge at a Holiday Inn, as detectives later discovered. A search of Stephen's bank card records revealed the hotel booking. When detectives combed through the hotel room, they stumbled upon another suicide note. Additionally, they found two bowls filled with cereal and rat poison. The suicide note contained a chilling message: "You will find us together, dead on a beach." Among the items recovered at the hotel was marijuana, condoms, and a DVD of the movie Donnie Darko. It was apparent that the couple had consumed some of the rat poison mixed with Fruit Loops and cake, although it had failed to be fatal. By the next day, both Stephen and Tyler had been extradited, and prosecutors announced that they were considering whether to charge Tyler as an adult in the murder. If she were tried as an adult and convicted, then she could be facing a sentence of life in prison. If convicted as a juvenile, however, she would be free at the age of 25. District Attorney Lisette Souter wanted her charged as an adult due to the seriousness of the crime, the circumstances, and the gravity. Tyler's defense attorney Mark Ralphs, however, said that he was going to argue that she should be charged as a minor. Meanwhile, Stephen was charged with the murder of Joanne and was ordered to be held without bail. In November, a hearing was held to determine whether Tyler should be charged as an adult. Testimony was presented regarding her role in the gruesome murder of her mother. Her journal was also entered into evidence. District Attorney Souter said that the testimony showed Tyler's sophistication in committing the crime. Defense Attorney Ralphs, however, suggested that Tyler was merely following the instructions of an older participant. The judge ultimately decided that Tyler could be tried as an adult in Joanne's murder. When announcing the decision, Judge James Wagoner stated, "There is no graver crime than matricide." He said that he didn't believe that Tyler could be rehabilitated in 10 years, stating, "This was not an easy decision to reach," but said that evidence showed criminal sophistication. Both Tyler and Stephen were ordered to stand trial for the murder together, and prosecutors announced that they weren't seeking the death penalty. In February, Tyler pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, while Stephen pleaded not guilty. Tyler's plea meant that if the case proceeded to trial and she were found guilty, a second trial would take place regarding her mental competency. Her defense attorney would need to prove that she didn't understand the nature of the murder or that she couldn't distinguish right from wrong. There was then a debate over the trials and whether Stephen and Tyler would be tried separately. it had been discovered that after committing the murder, Tyler had written a short story titled A Raven and His Killer. The story was set in medieval times, but it paralleled the murder of her mother Joanne. It detailed teen lovers driven to murder after their dreams were shattered by a woman who handed over the girl's journal to police. A judge ruled that if the prosecution wanted to enter the story into evidence, then the two trials could be separated. However, the judge then ruled that Stephen and Tyler would be standing trial together. He also ruled that the story could be entered into evidence. In September, Tyler appeared in court where she dramatically changed her not guilty plea to a guilty plea. She pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and admitted to the special circumstance of lying in wait. And the special circumstances for being witness to a crime. It was part of a plea agreement in which she would cooperate with prosecutors in Stephen's upcoming trial for a more lenient sentence. If she cooperated fully, the special circumstances would be stricken, and the charge would be reduced to second-degree murder. This would reduce her sentence in prison from 25 years to life to 15 years to life. After the plea, Stephen's defense attorney, Dan Wiener, suggested that it demonstrated his client's innocence. He stated, "What young girl would plead guilty if she didn't do it?" He then suggested that Stephen had arrived at the home after the murder had been carried out by Tyler. On the 17th of May, the murder trial for Stephen commenced with the seating of the jury. During the opening statements, it became apparent that the defense intended to shift the blame for Joanne's murder onto Tyler. Defense attorney Dan Wiener asserted that it was Tyler who had committed the act, claiming that when Stephen had arrived at the Witt home that fateful night, she greeted him at the door holding a blood-stained knife. According to defense attorney Wiener, Tyler confessed to killing her mother to Stephen. He further suggested that Stephen's confession to the murder was driven by his love for Tyler, stating, "That was a lie he told to protect Tyler Witt. He took responsibility for an act he did not commit." He painted Tyler as the mastermind behind the murder and said that she had a deep-rooted animosity for her mother that predated Stephen. He then went on to describe Tyler as a pathological liar and said that she had threatened her mother with a knife weeks before the murder. In her opening statements, prosecutor Lizette Souter countered the defense's narrative, asserting that while the murder was planned by the couple, it was Stephen who carried it out. Prosecutor Souter claimed that after Stephen and Tyler went upstairs to Joanne's bedroom, Tyler witnessed Stephen raising his knife above his head. According to the prosecution, Tyler dropped her own knife and assumed a fetal position, allowing Stephen to proceed with the murder alone. Prosecutor Souter read aloud a text message Stephen had sent to a friend after Joanne forbade him from seeing Tyler. In the text message, he expressed frustration with Joanne's actions, insinuating that she was trying to ruin his life. Prosecutor Souter then stated, "This is a case about a 19-year-old man and a 14-year-old girl with a forbidden love affair, to the point of sadistic murder." Both the prosecution and the defense agreed that Stephen and Tyler had attempted to take their own lives by ingesting rat poison shortly after committing the murder. During the first day of the trial, Matthew Wideman testified about Stephen and Tyler's visit to his home following the murder. He expressed shock upon hearing Stephen's confession, stating, "He never struck me as the kind of person to do something like that." During cross-examination by defense attorney Wiener, Matthew noted that Tyler didn't appear to be upset over her mother's death. In fact, he recalled Tyler previously expressing that her life would improve if her mother were no longer around. Matt Bogart also testified about the confession Stephen had made to him. Another friend, Edward Graham, testified next, telling the jury that after he became aware of the confession, he sent a message to Tyler on MySpace. He said, "You sicken me beyond anything. You really killed her?" Tyler replied, I didn't say that. Now she's gone. I'm weeping, but I'm free. She then added, LOL, in capital letters. Stephen's father, Richard, took the stand and provided testimony about the dinner he had with Stephen, Tyler and Joanne. He explained that he had arrived at the family's home to pick them up, but his son informed him that Joanne was asleep and basically passed out drunk. However, when they met at the restaurant, Joanne didn't appear to be impaired. Richard described his son as a calming influence in the relationship with Tyler, stating that he was supportive and helpful, which aligned with his personality. During the dinner, he observed Tyler and Joanne engaging in a verbal exchange regarding their intelligence. Joanne expressed frustration with accepting a job below her intellectual capabilities, and Tyler interjected, boasting about her own intelligence, describing herself as genius level. Following his testimony, the prosecution's star witness took to the stand, Tyler Witt. She calmly described how she and Stephen had planned the murder and matter-of-factly stated that they resorted to using a knife simply because they couldn't obtain a gun. Tyler proceeded to discuss her relationship with her mother, alleging that Joanne had physically abused her during her childhood. She claimed that her mother would kick the living crap out of her, but had only choked her on a couple of occasions. Tyler then revealed to the jury that she had various aspects of herself, almost like multiple personalities. She mentioned one named Toby, who she described as a demon from hell residing within her. Another personality she mentioned was Alex, who she referred to as an angel. She explained, three souls crowded in one body. According to Tyler, she experienced blackouts when she became enraged. She proceeded to recount the details of the murder plan and then the suicide pact. Tyler admitted to devising the plan, while Stephen responded that suicide would be the last resort. Tyler informed him that it was indeed their last resort, because he would go to prison, leading to their separation. Tyler said to the jury, "The only person who would notice me gone and call the police and point a finger at Boston would be my mother." Therefore, the plan then transformed and included the murder of Joanne before the suicide pact.
Mom podcast we play? Thanks to Babbel, I know what that means. Do you? Lately, I've been all about learning French with Babbel, and you totally should give it a whirl as well. Seriously, in just 3 weeks, Babbel can have you speaking a whole new language. The dream way to learn a language is by diving into a native-speaking country, but unfortunately that's not always on the cards for everybody. But guess what? Babbel's got your back as the next best thing. In as quick as just 3 weeks, you can pick up a new language with Babbel. As somebody who's all about exploring new places, let me tell you, Babbel's been my sidekick. With Babbel, you've got a golden opportunity to embark on your language adventure. Instead of dishing out a fortune on private tutors, Babbel hooks you up with these super quick 10-minute sessions designed by over 150 language experts. These bite-sized lessons are a game-changer. They've been my secret weapon for nailing stuff such as ordering food at a restaurant, calling a taxi, and just chatting with the locals. Babbel even has this super fancy speech recognition technology that polishes your pronunciation and gives you that legit accent. Here's a special, limited-time deal for my listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Morbidology listeners, babbel.com/morbidology. Get up to 55% off at babbel.com/morbidology, spelled babbel.com/morbidology. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Her testimony then shifted to the night of the murder, describing how she and Stephen approached Joanne's bedroom door. She recalled Stephen practicing slashing motions with the knife, and she fell to her knees, unable to go through with the murder. Tyler explained, "A knife in my hand. I turned to go into the room. I stood up and I was in the doorway, but I couldn't do it." as Stephen knifed Joanne to death. Tyler said that she covered her eyes and hummed. She recounted how Stephen emerged from Joanne's bedroom with blood-soaked pants and a tear of blood on his face. She recollected. He was holding the knife. He was just standing there at the stairs. I told him everything was going to be okay. Stephen appeared to be in shock and began crying. Tyler said that she began to comfort him. She remembered. I don't know if he specifically had blood on his hands, but I knew what he had just done. Afterwards, they went to Stephen's father's vacant home, where they burned Stephen's bloody clothing in the fireplace and washed up in the kitchen sink. Tyler told the jury how she noticed the teardrop of blood near Stephen's eye and expressed her desire for him not to wash it away. She explained, "When I saw it on his face, the first thing I thought was how ironic it was." She referred to teardrop tattoos beneath the eyes of killers in prison, suggesting that it symbolized something significant. During cross-examination by defense attorney Weiner, he suggested that Tyler had killed her mother during a psychological blackout when her other personality, Toby, took control. He asserted, "The truth is that it was you who killed your mother." Tyler responded firmly, "No." Following her testimony, it was revealed that Tyler had agreed to lead detectives to the murder weapon, which he said was tossed down a large drain outside Stephen's father's home. However, the murder weapon had never been recovered. Part of Tyler's plea hinged on her complete honesty with detectives. Testimony in the trial then shifted to DNA evidence. Senior criminologist Deanna Kaser told the jury that male DNA was found in the right hand and left hand scrapings of Joanne. There was also male DNA found on blood samples from her legs. She couldn't say whether the DNA had come from Stephen himself, only that it was male DNA. Defense attorney Robert Blazer attacked her findings and pointed out that it was impossible to determine when DNA deposits were created on an object. He wondered whether the male DNA could have come from multiple sources, but Deanna was adamant that the scrapings came through direct contact and not an innocent transfer. On the second week of the trial, Stephen took to the witness stand, recounting his version of events for the jury. He claimed that Tyler had called him to her house, where he found her holding a kitchen knife with a bloodstain on her trousers. According to Stephen, Tyler confessed, "I did it. I finally did it. My mom's gone forever." Stephen said he asked her, "What the hell did you do?" Tyler allegedly collapsed in his arms, saying that she did it for them. He asserted that their original plan was to take their own lives, and killing Joanne was never part of that plan. Stephen was then subjected to cross-examination by the prosecution, who asked about the male DNA found on Joanne. Stephen claimed that the DNA on her leg had come from him touching her after she was dead. As he said, he wasn't sure whether she was dead or not, so he touched her leg to see. Prosecutors, however, said that the DNA had gotten there when Joanne was fighting Stephen for her life. Following his testimony, the prosecution and defense presented their closing arguments. Defense attorney Weiner again told the jury that Tyler had committed the murder, describing her as mentally unstable. He stated, "It wasn't just her. It was Toby the demon. It was Alex the angel. All three of them would die. They all had to have Stephen to survive." Prosecutor Souter, however, reminded the jury of the male DNA found on Joanne's leg and underneath her fingernails. She stated, "A violent, calculated, desperate slaying of Joanne Witt. It is the only way to keep them out of jail, so that they could be with each other in eternity." The jury were then sent off to deliberate. They returned just 3 hours later with the verdict. They found Stephen Colver guilty of the first-degree murder of Joanne Witt. They also convicted him on a special circumstance enhancement of lying in wait, which meant that he would never be eligible for parole. Both Stephen and Tyler returned to court in August to hear their sentences. Before the sentences were imposed, victim impact statements were presented. Joanne's two brothers express their ill views of Stephen, with Mike stating,
"My hope is on the prison system, that the prison system will somehow create a slow and painful death. Young men like Mr. Culver are five times as likely to be attacked and brutalized in prison. And I actually find that to be a comforting statistic. They're 10 times as more likely to incur deadly sexual diseases."
Mike then added that he felt society should still carry out public executions, such as hangings and beheadings, as a way to provide closure to victims. Joanne's other brother, Stephen, said that there was no punishment to truly do justice in the case. He then added, "But a lifetime behind bars is a good start. I hope he has good luck with his new friends in prison, and I hope they embrace him warmly." The judge also heard from Joanne's father, Tyler's grandfather, Norb. He said that he and his wife had seen their health deteriorate since their daughter's murder by way of stress and lack of sleep. He then turned his attention to Stephen.
"Stephen Culver had a dark side. He took a 14-year-old girl and turned her into a heavy drug user, sex addict, and murderer. May he rot in the hell he wrote so often about in his journals."
Stephen was then sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, while Tyler was sentenced to 15 years to life. Judge Proud then stated, "It's a sad day when I have to sentence a 16-year-old to such a long prison term. And it's even sadder that it be for a brutal murder she'd admitted to." He then turned to Tyler and stated, "Joanne Witt loved her daughter. She was a protective and caring mother. She tried her best. I'm sorry, Miss Witt, because the person who loved you more than anything in the world, without reservation, is gone." After the sentence was handed down and Stephen and Tyler were carted off to custody, Tyler granted an interview with ABC. She told the reporter that she was upset that Stephen had turned on her and claimed that the murder was committed by her. She stated, "When I found out that he was going to point the finger at me, the only thing I could question was that he told me that he was going to love me no matter what, forever, for all eternity ever. And I guess that's not true anymore." On the 26th of August 2022, Tyler Witt was granted parole. Joanne Witt had devoted herself to giving her daughter a wonderful life. Although they had faced challenges in their relationship when Tyler was young, Joanne had proven to be a committed and loving mother, ensuring that her daughter had everything she needed. It's truly heartbreaking that in the end, Tyler repaid her mother's love and care in the most unimaginable way, by sacrificing her life to protect a child predator. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say the biggest thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Celia, Alicia, Marcia, and Jessica. The support up on there seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful. If you'd like to support Morbidology on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, behind the scenes including bonus videos, audio, and case files, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some cool merch. If you'd like to support the show in another way, you can always leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
I'm Eric Carter-Londine, the host of True Consequences podcast and a family advocate. And I'm Charlie Worrell, the host of Crimelines and a passionate storyteller. We've come together to create a new show, Crimelines and Consequences.
In each episode, we will explore cases, bringing in our unique perspectives and our shared belief that true crime is more than entertainment.
These human experiences can change the way we see the world. So come along and eavesdrop on our conversations about cases you've heard of.
And some you haven't.
And then join the conversation on social media by searching for Crimelines and Consequences on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Crimelines and Consequences is available now in your favorite podcast app and on YouTube.